Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly, episode, 63 now? Almost up to a fun binary number here, which might come as part of the discussion in the next little while. This is the Geeky Photo Podcast, where we talk about the industry news, the geekiest, the technical, the stuff that people might not be talking about, at least not as in-depth as we do on this show. And with me is a photographic educator, somebody that's in the retail space, which I want to have some discussion on for that, and an opinion that has opinions that I quite respect. Brian Weiss is here of Day Tripper Photo and of Henry's, the wonderful camera store in Canada here. Brian, how you doing?
Awesome, sir. Thank you very much. Nice intro. thank you. It's always good to be back on your show, and thanks again for asking me.
Well, I appreciate you you making the time. I'm sure we've both been up to different things. And before we get into the stories of the week, there's been a lot of new announcements in terms of new camera systems from Canon, Nikon, and Panasonic in the last little while. And of course, still, fresh is the Fuji medium format stuff and lots of other things. The industry is really transforming right now. So just from your perspective, you are the assistant manager at Henry's in Newmarket, Ontario, mm-hmm. and you see people walking through the door and buying camera stuffs. So what are people like buzzing about that may or may not be on the market right now that you're still waiting about? People asking questions, people walking away with new camera bodies. Where's the interest?
Well, I mean, I can only speak for what happens in the Newmarket area. And I know that, you know, we're coast to coast, so there's different trends in different areas. So I can really only speak for Newmarket, but I mean, mirrorless is huge. It seems like everybody is hot on mirrorless, and sometimes it's right for that customer and sometimes it's not. And that's part of the qualification process, you know, like trying to figure out what are you using it for? What applications? And a lot of the mirrorless cameras are still pretty new, like the new full frame Canon or the full frame Nikon. And like you have there, the full frame Panasonics. And as you know, Don, first generation product sometimes isn't always the right choice for some consumers. So at this point, there is some technology that is lacking in some departments. And I think once that is resolved, there'll be more of a swing that way. But there are some things that an SLR will do that a mirrorless just won't.
And, yeah, well, because it's a mature platform, right? Or even the Micro Four Thirds and mirrorless. I mean, they've been at that for about 10 years now. And so that I would consider mature too.
It's more than that. It's also more about actual functionality. Like, for example, in my world, when I'm shooting through a viewfinder in a lower light scenario in burst mode, like wrestling, if I'm using a mirrorless camera, sometimes there's a bit of a delay in the viewfinder and I can't quite have that same feel. It doesn't quite have that same connection to the moment.
I've had my dismays with electronic viewfinders over the years, especially the early ones. Mm. I remember looking through one of the first flagship Olympus viewfinders, and I was like, "Yuck!" It did not connect me to the photographic process.
And they're getting better.
They've gotten a lot better. I'm not sure if you've had the chance to look through an S1 or an S1R, but to me, that was the moment where that technology has gotten better than an optical viewfinder in almost every scenario, except for the most extreme low light scenarios. But in that scenario, you're going to be manually doing everything anyhow. It's not going to be much of an automatic run and gun process. And you can do more. You can display a histogram, or you can put overlays onto that that data. Various manufacturers will enhance that in different ways, and I'm sure more and more enhancements will come. But you can't do that with an optical viewfinder, at least not an exclusively optical viewfinder. I was wondering if there would be a hybrid, because you can have like a transparent LCD.
Well, Fuji has that in their Pro One camera back a couple years ago. Even it was like a rangefinder camera, but it would overlay the digital readout over the regular analog display, and you can.
And it was good. But it was kind of a Gen 1 device, and it didn't really do everything that I would hope that sort of thing.
And that's really where I'm going with this right now, is the fact that right now in some cases, and Panasonic and Olympus are the exception to the rule, and Sony is almost there. In most cases, the full-frame mirrorless camera, at least, is still going through its growing pains. And, sometimes it's worth it, sometimes it's not. So I think right now mirrorless is the hot ticket for sure, but it's not always the right choice.
Yeah. You know, when people ask me to recommend them a camera, it's like, okay, that's like asking me to recommend them a car.
Yeah.
You've given me no information whatsoever. You've just said, true. What car should I buy?
Yeah.
What do you want to use it for? You want to use it to go to the grocery store and occasionally, you know, drive across town and back? Well, then, you know, get yourself a tiny little Ford Fiesta or whatever.
And this is the problem I have with online shopping is you're hearing opinions from people who've only owned one format of camera or one brand of camera without the experience of using all the different brands. You're hearing one avenue of opinion sometimes, and it's not necessarily what you need your gear for. I think the best thing to do when buying a camera is to go into a place where you can get opinions and listen and get some good questions asked that you might not have thought about. And that'll lead you to the right choice, which is kind of like the mirrorless option. Like, what's hot? Sony A7s are ridiculous. I mean, the Sony mirrorless format, I think, is the most selling format we sell.
They've built that up over the last, when was the first A7 camera released? Was it six years ago?
Around there, maybe just then, just after. But realistically, the problem I have with it is there's all the accessories you need to get with them. Yeah, yeah. Sure, you're going to be buying a Sony mirrorless, but you're going to want to use Canon lenses because there's more of them. So you got to buy the Metabones $1,000 adapter, and then you got to get – so they're great, and a lot of people love them, and they do what they do very well. But again, like I'm saying, not for everybody, and that's where good conversation can go a long way.
Exactly, because everybody has the camera that's going to be right for them, especially moving forward when you're actively changing. There's silence on the front of whatever the successor to the Canon 1DX is going to be.
That's
because
right,
will that be a mirrorless camera? I mean, I'm sure they would have had some designs at some level down the pipeline on a traditional SLR, but are those days done for their flagship products now? And is that transition, are they going to put all their muscle into mirrorless? Because the traditional flapping mirror systems, they will be going away. They're mature now, and they're still very valuable now. And the lenses will be infinitely adaptable. The adapters, you know, from Canon, I don't know if they have all their super fancy ones out now with the drop-in filters and everything out. But that was a really novel design, and I'm looking forward to seeing how that plays out in practice. Sigma has just announced, what was it, the MC21, the compatibility from EF lenses and their own Sigma SA mount lenses to the L mount adapters. And the more of this intercompatibility that we have, it kind of makes photographers, when they're looking to their next camera, be a little bit more brand agnostic. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have to stick with Canon if all of your investment in optics and accessories will work on a Sony or work on a Lumix or work on a whatever new Foveon camera Sigma is going to be coming out with, et cetera.
Which I think is awesome. And there's different ways of looking at it. I mean, it's nice to be able to, if a new brand of camera comes along all of a sudden that we've never heard of, who knows what brand name, Brian Weiss camera brand, who knows? And and it has one or two features that are ergonomically beneficial and make a better photo for whatever reason, then to be able to use any lens on that, it's a game changer. You're not, as a business, you're not investing millions and billions of dollars in tech. You can just come out with adapters and just
And we have Sharp and Zeiss both coming out with cameras you know, in like making waves. Sharp with their 8K Micro Four Thirds, which I'm still a bit sketchy on, and then Zeiss with their first camera of all time, Android powered, and you know, that not interchangeable lens, mind you, but still a really unique product
and a start in the right direction, because that's where I see it going, is everybody just carrying that high-end camera with them all the time. Whatever that looks like, a phone, a camera, whatever, it's something that you'll have on you all the time that's going to make these high-resolution, good-quality photos that, you know, I would be happy with.
Yeah. Well, at the end of the day, it's the photographer that makes the good image, not the camera. But we obsess over the gear nonetheless. That is just the nature of humanity. And I'm sure you see that in some of the communities that you play into, like your day tripper photo community. And I want to bring that up on the start here before we get into our stories, because Google Plus officially shut down 2 days ago as we record this. And I know you closed your community down. The day tripper photo community was on Google Plus. You shut it down a few days before that, just to give everybody fair warning to move over to a new platform. Mm-hmm. Where did you go after Google Plus?
We went to MeWe, which I absolutely hate to say. It's almost like
the Nintendo Wii. It's like, okay, that just that's just no.
Vlogging, vlog, and MeWe. Those are like the things I just cannot. They don't make sense to me. Anyway, they do, but whatever. I call it DTP Wii. I think it sounds a little bit better. anyway, long story short, I went into a whole bunch of different options. I had some suggestions from my colleagues like Ross and other folks who said, try this service or that service. Discourse, I think, was one of them. Realistically, for the time that I'm putting into the community and for the interaction that I wanted to keep and for the amount of people we had that I needed to move over, it just seemed like the absolute best choice. You can do all different events. It has a calendar where you can actually see exactly all the day trips and events that we have planned very easily. Makes it very easy to create an event where people can register for the day trips. There's a community chat, which I love. So if I'm on my, I get off work early, it's a beautiful day, I get in the car, I'm going up to my secret place where everybody in my community knows where there's owl and eagles and all kinds of cool animals. I can just say, hey guys, I'm on my way to the spot. And next thing you know, there's a little bit of a meetup going on up there. So being able to do that as fluidly as the MeWe community platform allows, I think it's the right choice. And the fact that we can keep it as a, you have to ask to be a part of it, and we can have a few questions that I ask anybody who wants to join. So I just have an idea of what to expect if you're a bot, if you're a person, if you know, you actually care about photography or you just want to see people's photos, who knows?
Finish your thought.
The only thing I'm not too impressed with is, and this was the big sticking point for any new community I wanted to move to, was I needed to see EXIF information, and you cannot do that in this new platform. So when we're doing photo reviews, it's nice to be able to say constructive criticism based on settings. Like, oh, we feel this is a little bit soft, but we noticed that your shutter speed was this or blah, 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 right?
Right.
So it helps us understand what we're saying, so we're not just trying to, you know, we're not just blowing smoke. We can actually be have a fact behind us with what we're saying. Without the EXIF information, it's a little bit more difficult sometimes to give that kind of opinion, in my opinion. So what I've done is I've just asked people to post the EXIF information in their comment if they want
and
a review.
The platform is new, right? This might evolve, and they might add that functionality in the future. I was actually hoping that Flickr would have evolved at this point to have more of a community element. It's always been there, but it's quite stagnant now. And SmugMug, since they took over, haven't really done a single change to that kind of community platform. And
yeah, I looked
into
that.
If they had added some of that MeWe functionality or the Google Plus stuff that we liked into that platform, it would have made a lot more sense. And maybe that'll get there too. But I think you made the right choice based on where we were today or at the time when you made that decision. So talking about blowing smoke, I did that accidentally and literally the other day. I was setting up to do an ultraviolet fluorescence shot. I've got some flowers blooming and they're glowing beautifully under ultraviolet light. And so I put on my mad scientist hat and I set up all my modified ultraviolet flashes and I do a test shot and it's working and I'm about to do a final start sequence for this flower. And I hear a mini explosion inside one of the flashes. The xenon flash tube exploded inside of the flash.
Oh, man.
And so thankfully, they're really cheap flashes. I use some of the cheaper but brighter Young Nuo flashes. So I just got in the mail today another YN660. Cost me, $76 from B&H. And that I will tear apart and put back together in order to add that as my fourth ultraviolet flash back to that system.
Very cool. You got to love being able to pick up some cheap stuff like that.
Well, I only ever use it in manual and I only ever use it at full power. So I don't need any of the fancy through the lens metering stuff on that. Just, I remember I was using a Canon 580 EX2 and I was using it with an external battery pack out in the hot sun, shooting continuously with that thing. And the next day it didn't work. And I brought it to a camera repair guy here in Barrie who since retired. But he basically said I melted the flash tube on it. And it cost me $250 to repair the flash, which I begrudgingly paid because I didn't know of less expensive alternatives. Because for what I was using it for, to buy a brand new one for $76 US plus shipping and duty and all that stuff too. I mean, it equates to about maybe $120, $150 Canadian. But that's still less than repairing an existing flash. So
if it helps, salesman Brian for a second, the Godox flashes, the TT685, full radio receiver built in, the whole works, would be about the price you paid for that, just so you know.
What is the guide number on it? Do you know?
It's a 60.
So this one has a guide number of 217.
Sorry, what?
It has a guide number of 217 feet.
Oh, feet. I thought, okay, flash guide number 60.
Right. So I'm not sure the metric conversion of that on the top of my head, but this is in terms of guide sales number doesn't equal direct flash output. It means how far you can light a subject, and so you can have some conical differences in the way that light is focused. But it was the brightest one for that particular price, and I didn't need any wireless flash triggers. But Godox is another good brand too to take a look at. All right, yeah, Brian, let's get into the stories.
But we'll get to that down the road. Yes.
Yeah.
You go.
we've been nattering on for about 15 minutes here talking about interesting things, but we have some
fun stories
to get to.
We always do that when we get together, though.
It's just it's fun. This is the best part of my week to sit down and talk about this stuff. But it's also a tricky week because this week contains April Fools. And so when selecting these stories, it was very difficult for me to parse through what is real and what is fake. And so the first story was published on Petapixel on April 1st, but it came from a source from EOS HD who reported it on March 31st. And it was in their forums even earlier than that. So I'm going to take a grain of salt with this one, but I'm going to say that this is legitimate because it could possibly be real. And let's talk about it as if it is. And the headline is, Sony made a 100 megapixel and 6K full frame sensor for consumer cameras. And so we've got some product information and some diagrams and some details here, about 102 megapixels when you actually compute the exact numbers here. And it's not a surprise that Sony is working on a product like this. Canon has previously announced that they've got a 100 megapixel full frame sensor in the works, and even some industrial stuff that's going to push beyond 200 megapixels in certain cases. So this is kind of that next threshold in terms of what a high megapixel camera could offer. I have no idea how far along Sony is with this, but the details are starting to show themselves. Brian, do you have any desire, and is anybody walking into your store asking for a 100 megapixel camera?
Not at all. Not even. No. Just no. Okay, so here's the thing. Pixels are important for certain things. Pixels are image density, not image quality.
Yep.
So to get more pixels just means you can enlarge it more, you can crop it more, you can zoom in more, you can get in there more.
But if you were to crop bigger. if you were to crop a 5DS or 5DSR, which is a 50 megapixel camera body, down to 20 megapixels, and then compare those 20 megapixels to the 20 megapixels on a 1DX Mark II, which 20 megapixels are better? Right?
I would say the bigger pixels.
The bigger ones will typically be better. Now, it's always a rolling target from generation of product to the next, and so on and so forth. If you need more pixels, and some people do, I mean, when I was shooting with the S1R recently, I was doing some artwork reproduction stuff. And so I turned on the pixel shift technology and got nearly 200 megapixel images, 180 something megapixels, for that specific purpose. I wouldn't need that every day. I wouldn't need 100 megapixels, even 47, unless I'm making a very big print, is somewhat superfluous.
So this goes back
to... It's helpful to have, but you don't need it.
But this goes back to the buyer, the user, right? For you, Don, I could see you using it more than me because your detailed work, your macro work, your bugs, your flowers, the detail that you see, the snowflakes, all of the things that you shoot are very detail-oriented, where something that I may shoot would be more of a landscape or wrestling or, you know, not necessarily the same need for blowing it up or cropping it in or seeing the fine. I don't need to see Gabriel Fuerza's eyeball with the blood coming out. You know, I just, he's a wrestler, by the way. Just
wouldn't that be a cool close up though? Wouldn't it be fun to have that as an option if you had those pixels?
You can do that with 40 megapixels. I mean, you can absolutely. So here's the problem. Physics is physics. If you have a bigger sensor, you can put more pixels on there. But if your sensor's not getting bigger and you start putting more pixels on there, you're making your pixels smaller.
Right. And now, Sony, I think that they're mitigating the smaller pixel mentality here to some degree. I mean, I've shot with 20 megapixel Micro Four Thirds cameras, and I've loved the results that I've been able to get from that. Although, you know, when you get to low light performance and certain things, it doesn't really hold up to a larger sensor. So, it's not
I'm going shooting birds of prey on a day that's not perfectly sunny and not at the exact perfect time of day, which most people do. You're getting a camera, you happen to see a hawk on the pole. Wait, it's overcast. Too bad. There's a hawk on the pole. Take a picture, right? You're going to be shooting at 3200, 4000 ISO in the cameras that we have today to get the shutter speeds you need for sharpness. Now, if I'm shooting with a D850 or I'm shooting with a D750, the 750 will be better. Even though it's 24 megapixels, not 47 megapixels, it's going to be better because the pixels you have are better quality. They're bigger. They can soak up better light. That's what a pixel is, a light sensing diode. So you need to have bigger pixels. Now, if the D850 was a dual layer sensor and they had 20 megapixels and 20 megapixels, and you know, that would be awesome. I mean, that would be ideal because now you can crop in that picture of the hawk that's too far away that your 500 mil doesn't quite grab even further and further and keep that detail.
Well, one of the things that Sony is doing here, and I don't think I've seen it before, is when you have the way a sensor functions is you have these little wells that collect photons and translate that into electrons. And so you have an electric charge for every photosite on the camera sensor. And that gets read out in an entire row by an analog to digital converter. But what Sony is doing on this sensor is for one row will either contain red and green or green and blue, in the way a Bayer pattern is designed. And so for a row that contains red and green, there is a red analog to digital converter and a separate green one. And for the other, there's a green and a blue. In every other camera that I've seen designed, and I might have missed something along the way, please, anybody listening that you know, says otherwise, let me know. But it's always been the entire row gets read out equally. Now, this might be for better color accuracy. It might be for speed because you have a lot of data that has to be read off consistently. But this is also, to my eyes, new technology, a new way of going about reading off that camera sensor data. And maybe it equates to the bit depth now, which is 16-bit. Brian, do you know why that could be important?
Not quite sure, but as far as the number of colors, I know Fuji definitely has more greens than any other color in their sensors.
It's just a different arrangement of them.
A different arrangement. It's not different like this is, where it's the pattern is the same.
So it's the difference between an X-trans sensor, which is what Fuji uses, and this is a standard Bayer pattern, which is what everybody else in the industry uses. But bit depth of files, and this is an important thing to consider. Some medium format cameras in the past have used 16-bit analog to digital converters, but most RAW files today will be 14-bit. Some are 12, but most are 14-bit. So if we talk about bit depth, it's helpful to go right back to the very beginnings. If you have one bit of image data, that's black or white, that's on or off, zero or one, that is a bit, right? If you have two bit depths, then you have four possible states, 00, 01, 10, and 11. That's actually how the Game Boy camera worked back in the early 90s. I think it was 140 pixels square. And you would have black and white and two shades of gray. That's all it was capable of. It was a two-bit camera. So when we get 14 bits, it's 2 to the power of 14. And that means for every photo site on the sensor, every red, green, and blue pickup, you have 16,384 different pickups or different levels of brightness, I should say. If you were to add one bit to that, that number doubles to 32,768. And so if you're adding another bit to that up to 16 bits, then you have a total number of values of 65,536. So that's four times bigger than a 14-bit file in terms of the amount of color accuracy that you have per red, blue, and green color channel. And as we know, and I typically save my images as a TIFF file because they allow it to be a 16-bit file, and there's 32 bits too. We won't get into that, but that has a sort of a master quality to it. Then I'll go and re-edit or I'll print from that, etc. And so having extra bit depth from the sensor itself could be very useful. In comparison, by the way, 2 to the power of 8, that's 8-bit, that's a JPEG file, is only 256 different levels of brightness for red, blue, and green. So 256 for a JPEG versus 65,536 for what this RAW file should be capable of moving forward. how many people look at a JPEG on a website and think that is an amazing image, or they print from a JPEG and that's an amazing image? So is it a moot point that we go from 16,000 to 65,000? Well, kind of. But in some cases, that might be useful. And that's why they've rolled that into some professional medium format cameras in the past. Good to see that, at least as an option being available on a full frame sensor.
I just think it's nice that they're pushing technology. I think they have to continue pushing technology. Whether it's something that the masses are going to buy or not is irrelevant in this case. I think this is more the future. As you say, some cameras are actually talking about 250 megapixels.
Yeah, Canon has, I think they're using that for industrial purposes, an APS-H sensor. That's what the old 1D camera bodies would have used versus the 1DS. They would have been a slightly smaller format than full frame, but not as small as APS-C. And I can figure out some industrial applications for having super high resolutions for product quality testing, tolerances that are extremely tight that you need to monitor on a constant basis. But I don't think the consumer space needs that for any meaningful purpose, at least not today. But this is a fun new sensor from Sony that whether or not this is an April Fool's gag here, because it did come out around the same time, it is very viable that this is one of, or at least something very similar to the next product that that Sony is going to be working on here. So looking forward to seeing what comes next, because they haven't really announced anything for what the successor of the A7 III is in terms of what's under the hood. And there will be successors to the A7 R3 and the A9 and everything else. They're not going to stop making cameras. They're just going to make them better with better equipment, better processors, better sensors, and everything else. So, Brian, let's move on to the next story here. Talking about innovation, I guess I could call it in tongue-in-cheek. First of all, what are your thoughts on creative filters?
I am... I don't know. I'm a little bit torn. On one hand, I have them.
A nice like triple prism filter, yeah, right? A triangular one.
I mean, they're fun.
And a pentagonal one. I got some of those too.
You can
create
things.
Like almost like a kaleidoscope effect.
Exactly. You can do some really neat things with them. And I'm all for, you know, people in camera creating fun effects and doing that. That thing. I'd rather you do that in camera than in post, just sitting on a computer, adding flares and stuff. But I also love it for the economy factor, I guess you could say, because, you know, the world just needs people to spend more money. And if you're going to spend more money on things that you're only going to use once, which, by the way, I ask myself how often I've used these. Never. So people spend the money on it. They'll have fun with it for a little while, and then it'll end up in one of these little cases shoved in a closet that you'll have to pull out next time you're on Don Komarachka's show.
Yeah, well, and I've got some of those same cases, and those are old. I mean, maybe yours are more modern, but they've existed. Those filters have existed since the 1970s.
Oh, yeah.
So this Petapixel article, although I think it's everywhere now, titled, "These Lens Filters Have Prisms Built In for Creative Effects." So Prism Lens FX has unveiled a set of variable prism filters. And the article continues to say that these are lens filters with prisms built right into them for capturing creative effects and in photos and videos. Now, video is important for some of the stuff, because if you want to try and create flare after the fact in post, it's really hard to get it accurate to the scene. It's much easier if you can do something in camera. And I actually have a lens that I intentionally had all of the coatings stripped off of the optics to create stronger flares for certain effects. And I've used it exactly 3 times. so it's not something that I'm going to be using often, but I'm looking at these filters, and this just seems like if I had a high school like science fair project, this is what I might be able to come up with if I was into photography. Basically, we have filters that look like cheap ultraviolet filters. One of them has, they claim it's a prism, but it looks like a line just running across it that you might be able to do with a 3D printer of plastic or something like that. And another one that has a disconnected set of lines that kind of connect together in the middle, like almost like a shattering effect. And then another one that looks like it has some just pieces of I don't know, like rock tumbled glass that is stuck to it. Some of them have different bits of colors on it and what have you, to create interesting effects. And looking at the images, they're creating flare and glare and sort of visual artifacts that might be useful in some cases. But, okay, the price. The price is what gets me. $75 each for these filters, or if you want to buy the whole set, $195 US.
Send me 50 cents and I'll give you this. This is a beautiful prism filter. And you can turn it. So, look, it has a turny thing. You can turn it.
I don't even see these ones. I hope they can turn.
They don't have a turny thing. You have to turn the whole
thing.
They
don't have a turny thing?
No. No, they may. I don't know. It's probably two pieces.
It doesn't look like it does, like from the product photos, and it doesn't like illustrate the fact that they do turn. They might. But
I like how it's a turny thing became a thing. I like that.
If you were to browse eBay for an antiquated ultraviolet filter. Ooh. And that might create ghosting and flare and glare, but that's what you're after here. Buy one of those and just gently tap it with a hammer to shatter it in like a spiderweb kind of pattern. I think that would be more effective than at least one of these three filters. And for the other one, what if you were to take your keys and like scratch it all the way across in one direction and scratch it all the way across in the other direction? I think that would be more effective and more unique than any of these.
So true. A friend of mine, you know him as well. He did a YouTube vlog, I guess, on hacks that you can do. And he took his knife and he put it on the edge of the lens and just kind of bounced the light from the edge blade of his knife against the lens. And, you know, there's so many things you can do if you just have a creative mind. To spend that kind of money on these, I'm sure somebody will pay.
I'm sure. And the manufacturing cost on this is incredibly low. I'm sure the margins are huge at that level. This could be an item that sadly would be successful in a retail presence if you have the right people trying to sell them because they're getting a certain spiff or incentive for doing so. A portrait photographer that wants to add a little bit of extra in-camera flair to a photograph, this is a way that you can trade dollars for that effect rather than trading a little tiny bit of elbow grease for the same thing and probably better.
Mm-hmm. And you'd feel more accomplished because you did it yourself.
You know what? There's a lot of DIY stuff that I want to try and play around with. One of them is to take a lens cap, and I think I've mentioned this before, but I want to create my own interesting bokeh shapes, right? And I've got some waterhouse apertures for one of my Lomography lenses that are all in different shapes, and the bokeh in the background becomes that shape. Well, and I haven't seen anybody take me up on this idea, but if you can take one of those super cheap lens caps and cut out the center of it so that it'll just clip onto the camera and that's the mechanism for it. And then take some, I don't know, tie clips or book corner edges or something that you can put around that to then slide something into. And then slide in a piece of acetate, the overhead projector material, that you've either drawn something on with a marker that has an opening that's clear, or you've used your printer to print on that, because a lot of the stuff is inkjet compatible, and you can print out your own aperture shape and slide that into this and have that as a fun piece. And it's very inventive, and I just, it's one of my many ideas I haven't gotten to yet. But you have to be inventive with this stuff. That the total cost on doing that is like less than $10. Why would you spend $75 for a filter that does this effect when I've been given boxes of old camera stuff, you know, dark rooms closing down at professional photo studios or people just clearing out their junk. And in there is boxes of gel filters and ultraviolet filters for the cameras and old lenses and all sorts of archaic stuff. I could go through and find an appropriately sized UV filter from that. Again, you could buy something like that for a couple of bucks on eBay and get exactly the same effects. And you know what? I want to encourage people to actually do that.
For sure.
Because the in-camera experience has always been something useful. Yes, you can replicate it in post. But if you turn the camera just right and you say, oh, you know, I love the way that diagonal line is coming across and I couldn't have predicted how that was going to look, and you get that in camera, then that, I think, is a more valuable shot than anything you would have been able to design in post-processing.
I've got this 24-85 lens. It's probably my favorite lens I've ever actually owned. It's a macro. I get super close. This is what I use for all my light painting shots and so on. It's got a tiny, tiny, tiny little chip on the surface of the lens. And if I shine the light just the right way, I get the coolest flare from that. And I've learned how to do that. And if I'm thinking about it and I want to be purposeful, I can use my broken lens and do the same thing. Now, and
if you want to avoid that, just put the lens hood on and you'll never see that problem.
I was just going to say, I advise everybody to just crack your front of your lens and nudge.
Well, you know, it's funny because I remember a lens rentals article where they had a Sigma 300 to 800, I think, where the front lens element was just completely spiderweb crap shattered. And it was like they took a photo, I think, of like of a dumpster or something, and it was soft and you couldn't quite figure out why. Like, it didn't look like it was a major malfunction, and they show the complete destruction of the main front element. Oh. And it was amazing how well a lens can survive such destruction.
Well, we see it all the time. Yeah. All the time. People coming in with broken filters and lenses survive.
Let's talk about another broken system, shall we?
Please.
Let's talk about Getty Images, which, you know what? They are an industry standard. They are an icon. They are a pillar of the photographic space. They have some of the most valuable image catalogs in the world, and they have some of the best photographers represented within Getty Images. And so I shouldn't be all hard on them, but they have acted, in my opinion, in a way that is counter to the spirit of free artistry a number of times. And so this was reported by DP Review. Getty Images is being sued over deceptive image licensing of deceptive licensing of public domain images. And so Getty's been doing this for a while. There's been a number of cases of this, and they are now being sued by a company. And for a while, I was trying to figure out, how do you sue Getty Images over this? Even if they're doing it, nobody owns the images. The image owner can't sue them because they intentionally put the image out for free. So you can't be an entity to defend that. But CIXXFIVE, so 65 Concepts LLC, is the plaintiff in this case, and Getty Images is the defendant. So they licensed a number of images from Getty that were public domain images, and I'm guessing they figured out after the fact that they didn't actually have to pay a license for these photographs. Getty has been collecting public domain images and including them in their catalogs as rights managed photographs that can charge a very tidy sum for an image that you don't have to pay any money, not a penny, to use because it's public domain. Brian, your thoughts?
It's horrible. It's just horrible. I mean, basically, you have a company counting on the fact that people aren't going to pay attention to what they're charged, writing it. It's just like, I don't want to say it, it's just like any other Rogers or Bell or any of these things with their little surcharges and subcharges. And if you don't catch them on it, you keep paying for it. So they were really counting on that loophole to make as much money as they possibly can. So yeah, I do believe that they should be sued for however much money is being sued for. Who knows?
Why well, those and that, that's the problem, because if you put an image in the public domain and Getty licenses that image, I am of the full respect that any image that Getty has made or any money that Getty has made from that image will be back in your pocket as the original creator, even if that image is in the public domain or that creator's estate or descendants, because some of the stuff goes back quite a ways.
So it's like the link that you sent me, Carol Highsmith.
Carol M. Highsmith, she's suing Getty Images. I have no idea what the result of the suit was. She was asking for $1 billion, and I think that's a bit of a stretch.
She goes into the math, you know.
You do go into the math of this, but basically she put all of her work into the public domain and then found Getty selling it all. And that is just, to me, you know, despicable is not too strong a word, I don't think, in this particular case. And I was thinking, you know, I put one of my photographs in the public domain. I put one of my snowflake images, was it 2 years ago, just to see where it would end up. And it's ended up in a variety of different places, wedding invitations and crochet patterns and Photoshop brush patterns and all sorts of weird places. And, you know, it was a fun experiment to see where it would go. Just on a lark, I went and I checked out the Getty Images catalog and I just typed in snowflakes. Do you know what I found, Brian?
Your ones that you
I did not find my image. No, okay. that would have been too perfect. But I did find Snowflake images from Wilson Bentley, a.k.a. Snowflake Bentley, a Vermont farmer in the late 1800s that did a lot of snowflake photography, the grandfather of snowflake photography that we know and love today. I mean, not figuratively, if you're talking about a genetic relation to me, I have no relation. But his work was done prior to, at least the bulk of it, prior to 1923, which is when the copyright laws in the U.S. really came into effect. And so his work is in the public domain. And in fact, when I was publishing my book, Sky Crystals, I wanted to put one of his images in there. And I contacted the Bentley Museum in Jericho, Vermont. And they said, yeah, you know, you could use these images for free. You can buy a CD with our images on it, and you could use any of those. It's public domain stuff. And you'll just get the higher resolution ones when you buy the CD for, cost me $20. Like, it wasn't a huge fee. And I wanted to support them. So, sure, spent that money. Now, if I were to license and, you know, fill in all the check boxes and drop down things on the Getty Images website, I can get the cost of licensing one of Wilson Bentley's photographs to over $1,500 Canadian.
Wow.
When it would cost me $20 for a CD of hundreds of them from the museum. And it's public domain. You know, it's not just this one case. Getty Images, I mean, I'm sure I can find more cases if I did some digging. This one was relative to me. And it's upsetting. I mean, I use the Getty Images rights-managed photo calculator quite frequently because it's a great way to figure out what a fair value license is to a client. But this behavior, I mean, alleged behavior, sure, it's not proven in court. We have to state that, I guess.
Well, I mean, the fact that you know that you could buy a CD for $20 or pay that much to get it through Getty, that tells you something right there.
Yeah. And it's very frustrating to see where the industry is going from this perspective. And we have a lot of challenges moving forward because a predatory behavior from a very big company like that trickles down, mm-hmm. right? You know, I have a lot of people that often ask me to use my images for free. And that's the other side of the equation too. And there was a fun April Fool's sort of exposure calculator that was going around the internet as well, where if you could plug in all your values, this is how many exposures you would be given, which is based on a fun comic. And maybe I'll put a link to this in the show notes. And it basically says those exposure bucks are worth absolutely nothing in any possible scenario. How many exposure bucks would translate to real dollars? Well, like over $1,000 or additional new client leads or whatever else it happens to be. You know, you have to give something tangible to people in the creative space, but robbing from them on the other side of the equation, it just makes me, I'm not an angry person. This makes me angry.
This is actually a big reason why I don't put my stuff out there for sale, because you're ripped off left, right, and center. It doesn't matter where you do it, unless you do it like you do, Don, where you have a draw. People go to your website and buy prints from your site, and you have control over the printing. And not everybody has that ability, or you know, can manage that kind of platform. So for you to do it, it makes sense. But I don't know. It's just, I just stay away from.
I want to see how this shakes out. I really want to see how this class action works out, because again, it's a company that licensed the images that is suing Getty, not the original rights holder, because there is no original rights holder because it's public domain. And that's where this gets really sticky. And I think that's why Getty has been able to get away with this for so long. And I really hope that it falls in favor of the plaintiff, because if this just goes back to Getty saying, hey, you know what, you can't stop us, so we're just going to keep going, and people with a little bit of naivety and they don't understand that certain images are free. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting. In the other article with Carol M. Highsmith, it says the legal claim alleges statutory damages at up to $468,875,000. But because of a ruling against Getty in Morrell versus Getty, a previous copyright case, the damages can reportedly be tripled to deter bad faith business practices. So it's exactly what you're saying. Like, this is bad faith business practices again.
Yeah.
And this article, by the way, was 2016.
That case was ever settled.
That was 2016.
And Getty continues, you know, you can put the legal language in front of them time and time again, and they have not changed their stance. You can license an image from NASA of Saturn, for $700 from Getty Images. It's free from NASA because everything from NASA is public domain. So
that's sad.
Yeah, it is. So everybody, if you are potentially thinking of using Getty Images or anything that Getty owns, they own iStock Photo and a bunch of other stuff, I'm sure, then you know what? Maybe send an angry letter before you do.
That's why I haven't uploaded to iStock in forever, because as soon as Getty took over.
I pulled all of my stuff off of iStock Photo well before the Getty Getty purchase, because I realized my images were worth more than what MicroStock payments were being dished out. I have a magazine cover on the journal Nature Structural and Molecular Biology that I got paid $1.50 for. And they thankfully linked back to me, so I actually knew about it, because they are very opaque about how, like, if somebody licenses your images, you don't get to know who licensed it. It's completely hidden from you. And they sent me a complimentary copy of that that issue so that I could have the cover shot and have it framed.
That's cool.
If I had to buy that issue, it would have cost me over $300 without a subscription on an ongoing basis to get a single issue of that journal Nature publication. And they paid me $1.50 for using it. So that was that was the moment. Then I completely went away from all of that stuff.
Wow.
Let's go to a lighter note, shall we?
Yeah.
As we bring down the stories. So as I said, I was avoiding April Fool's stuff, but then I saw Petapixel had kind of amalgamated it all together across the internet. All the fun April Fool's gags in the photo industry for 2019. And there was some pretty funny ones in here. I don't know. Does anything stand out to you, Brian?
Well, the left-handed camera, of course.
Oh, a left-handed. Wouldn't that be a really bad engineering and marketing decision to ever produce?
Well, the way that they have it done, I mean, there's just no way you can hold that. That's
No. I mean, that was, again, a gimmick. And I was wondering if they just mirrored things in weird ways.
But, they took like a D7000, cut off one side, pasted it to the other side.
Yeah. So yeah, there are some things that are silly, but hey, it would be great. I had a large format camera. It was one of the Crown cameras. I can't remember exactly which one it was, and it had a left-handed grip on it. And it was cool, you know, to have that left-handed grip on the camera. They have existed in the past. And if you really want a left-handed camera, go back to the large format, you know, reporter cameras, and you might find something there.
Right.
No, some of them, like, there was silly stuff, like Sony introducing the A8S.
With 3,276,800 ISO.
And an SD card photo printer that prints out images that are about the size of my fingernail, because the SD card is the printer. some of them that were kind of interesting, though, was that the Pentax MED. The Pentax ME, by the way, was a really small format, but still almost full frame SLR. Instead of getting 36 shots on a roll, you would get 39, I believe. So just ever so slightly smaller image circle on that. And it was very compact, but had a very big viewfinder. And so in the film era, it kind of stood out as a very fun, interesting camera. And if that kind of format would be produced in the digital world, well, people would kind of perk up and raise an eyebrow and say, well, maybe I should pay attention to that. The mock-up was completely fake, because there's a control dial on the front that is actually stretched out and is oval rather than circular. And so, I mean, immediately it jumps up to me as being fake. And so then Elon Musk's camera ambitions. It's time to redefine the future of photography, this tweet says. Today, we're announcing a partnership with Yashica to work on the greatest camera ever made. And they show a logo of the Boring Company and the Yashica Y35. So, the greatest camera ever made to make that happen. I didn't even verify that was a tweet from Elon. It just seems so silly that it's not even really worth talking about. A brassed camera. This is like if you go to the store and you actually buy pre-ripped jeans, you can get a camera that has all of the really nice paint job completely scuffed and removed to various different degrees. Things people come up with for April Fool's It's just crazy.
There was it reminds me though, like my friend Sean and I have been working on a project, the 8 to 1600 millimeter f/1.4 macro with digital display and 3D technology lens that we were trying to work on. I think we're very close to production. We only need a couple $1 million in research funds before we can finalize it. But, you know, we have very interested people in what we're doing. And,
you know, to be fair, was it Samsung with some of their NX lenses? You know, they're out of business now, at least in the camera market. But they had a beam splitter built into the lens that you could flip a switch and make a lens switch from 2D to 3D based on an internal beam splitter design inside the lens itself. And so that technology exists. There's patents for that. Go ahead and license them. You don't have to do the R&D yourself.
See, this is what bothered me about we talked about this before, the April Fool's joke that really just burned my craw forever. Yep. Still does to this day. And you tell me to get over it, Brian, get over it. He's a good guy. And I know he is, but the Chris Marquardt, when he did the invisible camera for April Fool's, now he talked about it months ahead of time. And he asked people who are interested in groundbreaking technology to be beta testers for this. And I thought, all right, well, you know, so there's a lot out there I don't know.
What is the invisible camera?
Well, it was invisible camera. Basically, it's an infinite light path camera with infinite depth of field control. And it's made out of plexiglass, but apparently has a special film technology that when you put the film in the back, with the way light passes through, it hits this film in a certain way that gives you, you know, blah, 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 blah. So I'm thinking, all right, well, I don't know everything about everything. Right? Like, I'm not Don Komarechka or Rosh.
No, I fell for this too.
So I maybe it's possible. I keep an open mind. Maybe it's possible that there's this really cool new technology. I want to be in on this. I know Chris Marquardt. I listen to his podcast. I love it. I think he's great. He talks the way I want to be talked to. And I enjoyed listening to him. So I put my name in. And then finally on April 1st, he comes out, oh, it's just a big joke. Everybody fell for it. Ha, ha, ha. It felt like an episode of The Champ on Q107. Ah, Ultramaroon fell for it. Head faking with a whatever, you know. Like,
engineers, physicists, and scientists fell for it too, Brian. And that was kind of the magic of it. It was so believable, so well done. And I love science fiction. I love trying to believe beyond the boundaries of our current technology. And we are always pushing those boundaries. To have a camera that if light is coming from an obtuse or unusual angle, that it would not be detected by a certain type of film, only light that would come through the lens. I'm being very dyslexic today in the way that I'm saying things, that would only be the detectable light that would be able to activate an image on the film. And I thought, okay, I don't know everything about everything. Maybe that's possible. Maybe you could make it so that the light could only come from those angles and thereby create an interesting image. And this project from Chris, yes, it was an April Fool's joke. The invisible camera was non-existent. And the prototype that they had showed off was like so wobbly and almost about falling off. I talked to Alan Attridge, who is a Canadian photographer now living in Germany, who shot that entire sequence, and he's a regular on this podcast. I think there was one episode that we actually talked about this. Actually, in that sense, understanding exactly what went into that gimmick, the whole joke, and making it as believable as possible, that I think is a bit of artistry.
I have great appreciation for that. Trust me, in hindsight, I totally do. It's the way that it was almost like laughing at people for believing it. How could they possibly believe it? How stupid are they? Like, wait, what?
I'm humble enough to admit my own defeat in this scenario. And yeah, you know what? It's a defeat because I gave credibility to that reputation because I trusted the person and that person lied to me, and that should hurt trust in some way. But I, you know, I've since regained it in many ways.
Well, I know you have a different relationship, and
I actually bought with the invisible camera evolved into the Chris Marquardt International Pinhole Camera, and I bought one of those. There was 10 made, and I have serial number 1. So, yeah, I'm not with that one. If anybody wants to offer me $1 million for it, well, maybe. But until that day happens, I have serial number one of the MIP.
There you go.
And I'll keep that handy. Talking about gear and and objects of desire. Brian, if we go into the picks of the week, what would your pick this week be?
Well, I'm a very layman's terms kind of person. I'm not uber technical and so on. For me, when it comes down to something that I would recommend as something people would want, a pick of like something that people would want to pick, it's something that most people who are into photography should be able to afford and is functional and better than most other things. So for me, it's the Nikon 200 to 500 f/5.6 lens. There are better lenses in the world, but under $3,000, I've never ever played with anything half as good. It's great on a crop sensor. It's great on a full frame. If you're into birding and you want to step up your game a little bit, get away from the 7300 VR or no offense, I like Sigma and Tamron, but the 150 to 600s or any of those, to get the sharpness that you would get in the 200 to 500, you're buying one of their sport lenses, which is over $2,000, $2,500, 6 pounds. You know, it's, I really just love that 200 to 500. I use it as often as I possibly can. The shots I make with it are as sharp as I could possibly hope for. And I've recommended it to hundreds of people and they've all really liked it. So for the money you pay, best value by far in a super telephoto for Nikon.
And it's good to invest in optics. And one of the things that's great about the telephoto optics is because they don't really have an advantage if you go to a mirrorless platform, the way that you can have the objective element closer to the sensor. Right. And that's helpful in some of the new designs for wide angle lenses and more versatile zoom lenses that have a wide angle element. If you can get the distance between the rear element and the sensor to be closer, you can make a simpler and more effective and more valuable optical design. But when you have a telephoto lens, that rear element is already a great distance away. And so you won't have any real benefit going to a telephoto lens designed for a mirrorless platform versus one that was designed for an SLR platform that you've adapted. So an investment on that kind of scale from 200 to 400, clearly in the telephoto range, will last you a very, very long time, even in this transition to mirrorless.
For sure. And that's, of course, if you are an Nikon user. If you're a Canon user, you can't really get that. They have a 100 to 400.
Oh, yeah. That's worth more than my car.
Yeah. Well, no, the 100 to 400 is not bad. It's the 200 to 400.
The 200 to 400. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Just like Nikon's 200 to 400 is that kind of price point. The 200 to 500 is the one I'm talking about. And that one is right. Just beauty. It's nice and smooth and sharp. It's like 1750 at its most expensive, 1800. But yeah, that's what I would suggest as my pick.
That's actually a very good pick, because when I think about telephoto lenses, I think dollar signs in my eyes that I won't necessarily be able to afford. Mm-hmm. I borrowed a fellow photographer, Ethan Mellig's 500 millimeter Canon lens to go to the Yukon. This was back in 2014. And I had teleconverters galore to push that all the way up to 1,000. And I also had a 1.4 times teleconverter. And it was a great lens. But I'd never own it. I borrowed it from a friend because its price tag scares me.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I have insurance for that if I were, you know, to dunk it, you know, if the canoe capsized or whatever. But I wouldn't have that price tag being, hey, you know, that's a smart business move for the amount of times that I would use it. But if I had something more versatile than just 500 plus teleconverters, you know, 200 to 500, that is a really nice range. Mm-hmm. You could even use that as a portrait lens in some cases.
I have, actually. Well, Nikon also has their 500, the PF, the new electronic aperture version. Beautiful lens, super lightweight, really compact, absolutely gorgeous, very sharp. For $5,000, it could be yours too.
but the price tag scares me away.
This is it, right? Like, so for the 200 to 500 to be $1,800 Canadian at its most expensive, occasionally I've seen it for Boxing Week, it was like $1,550. Absolutely best value for sure.
Yep.
And it's sharp. Awesome. It's actually very sharp.
Perfect. Well, thank you for that pick, Brian. I'll get into mine.
Yes, Don, what is your pick?
Well, it's one that's been on my radar for a little while, and I've shot with, and full disclosure, Panasonic is a sponsor of mine. I'm one of their brand ambassadors. So I had early access to the S1 and the S1R. And I used the S1 quite a bit over the wintertime because it was given to me before the S1R to do some snowflake photography. And 24 megapixels, big pixels, high quality pixels, really liked it, especially for some of the video functionality within that camera. And I've just been given, I'm a couple days into it right now, the S1R. And or about a week and a half or so. And the S1R with the 24-105 lens, which is, I had the Canon 24-105, very versatile lens. It was a great travel lens. This one beats the Canon lens if you get it in the kit. Its closest focusing distance is under a foot. And so it makes a very good macro lens as well. It's not true macro, but it's versatile enough at least to get you within that realm. And 47 megapixels, I didn't think I needed in many cases, and in a lot of them I don't. But for some use cases where I want to try and stay further back from a subject and then crop in a little bit, then I have a greater depth of field on a macro scale. If I was to be doing video on this thing, it's absolutely phenomenal. The viewfinder is amazing. And I bought the crazy expensive, don't buy it, the NovoFlex EF to L mount adapter, which is now fully functional in the version 1.0 firmware, but Sigma's coming out with their better adapter. So I mean, go for that one of anything. But I wanted to have early access and use this for all sorts of craziness that, that I get into in my mad scientist laboratory here. And it has performed exceptionally well. I've shot this all the way up to ISO 12,800. It's not going to be the same ISO 12,800 as a 20 megapixel flagship camera from somebody else, because you do sacrifice a bit by the number of pixels to the quality of each and every one of them. But if I were to scale that 47 megapixels down to 20, it beats it. And so that if you want to do the pixel binning to make the difference there, then this camera, the S1R, is my pick. I think they're currently shipping now. So you should be able to get them in your hands. Maybe you've pre-ordered one. Maybe you've been thinking about what your next camera body is going to be. Because of the L-Mount Alliance and Sigma's ability to retrofit existing lenses and their lens mount adapters, you'll have a lot of lenses to choose from, not just from Panasonic. If you've got the budget for Leica lenses, they've got them too. I won't be buying any of those. But this is my pick of the week. And I'm very happy to state that because I like to stay unbiased. I do have sponsors, and I try not to pick my sponsors very frequently in terms of those picks, because I don't want it to seem like they've purchased that pick. They most certainly haven't. They haven't paid me any money to specifically state this right now, that this is my pick for this episode. But if I look at all the photographic gear that I've been playing with lately, this camera and lens combination specifically, it has performed beyond my expectations. And so there you have it. That is my pick.
Would you put that up against 1DX Mark II?
Well, I've shot with the 1DX Mark II for years, right? Mm-hmm. And so the only caveat is when you have that much data running through the camera. I've only ever used the 1DX Mark II at like 7 to 9 frames per second. It can do 14, but the flashes that I use don't keep up that well at that speed, etc. So if I dial that down to the same thing, and this is about 8 frames per second, then the only issue is that the buffer fills up faster than it does on the 1DX Mark II, which effectively shooting RAW, not RAW plus JPEG, but just RAW, would have no buffer whatsoever. Here, I get to a buffer after like 100 shots.
Hmm.
And how many people do 100 plus shot bursts?
Mm-hmm.
Very, very few. So that is a small caveat that most people won't ever encounter.
Well, my D7100 has a buffer of 6 photos. So yeah, that would be nice. So the body on that's $5,000.
Yep.
The kit that you have is 6,300.
Canadian, we're talking, right?
Yes, exactly. Yep. The lens that's on there is actually the same price as the lens that I recommended.
There you go. And you get it in a nice kit. And if you're going to spend money on camera gear today, yeah, you can spend a ton of money on like the Leica Q2 that they just announced, had the same resolution sensor and a fixed lens. And it was actually quite appealing until I saw the price tag, which was about the same price as this combination. But now I have the full flexibility of changing the lenses and being creative and everything else. And so I really quite enjoy this. It's not for everybody because the resolution isn't for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
if you don't need that resolution, and I'm going to say half of the photographers out there will never fully utilize what that resolution becomes, then the S1 is a less expensive alternative that, again, I used extensively. Half of my Snowflake series this year was shot with the S1. And I was very happy with that. Some with the GH5S too, just because I had it here and I figured why not test it all out. But the S1 or the S1R, really, because the S1R is in my hands right now. It's the one that I would recommend. It is the most forward-looking camera I think I've actually had my hands on, not having tested every camera in the world. But there's a lot of really nice features, and Panasonic is putting every bit of muscle that they can into making this the best product available. And the entire platform moving forward with more lenses from them and their partners. I think it's a good bet. At least it is for me. I'm sponsored by them, so that makes a lot of sense. But if I'm trying to be unbiased and you're looking to buy into a new camera system, I haven't really shot much with the 24-105. I did some of my UV shots recently with that. Most of the stuff has been adapted lenses, antiquated lenses that I just put on for fun, or my Canon MPE 65, which performed exceptionally well. I shot one snowflake with that before winter ended. I haven't published that one yet, but the detail and the quality, the resolution is all there. So that's my pick.
Very cool. I've always been a Panasonic fan. I'm not sponsored by them in any way. I'm not sponsored by any camera manufacturer. Hint, nudge, nudge, somebody, anybody. no, but I've always, like, I was talking to you yesterday, and I mentioned that I'd been at Henry's for 13 years. It's actually 14 years. It started in 2005. And since day one, I've always been a Panasonic fan. Their menus are easiest. Their build quality is great. Their lenses are fantastic. They were the first to come out as a mirrorless camera with Olympus. Their selection of mirrorless lenses along with Olympus is bigger than anybody else's. The only issue I ever had was the 4/3 sensor. It was just not giving me the detail I needed where I was shooting at higher ISO, as you know what I'm talking about. So I'm really curious to see how these are, because I would be the type of guy to switch over. However, I really like the big open mount on the Nikon mirrorless to get those 0.96 aperture lenses and whatever else they may end up being able to do because of that huge opening on the Nikon. So I want to give them a couple more generations before I give up on it. But if I were to make a move, it would, for me, it would either be between mirrorless wise, either Fuji, which I think they don't do anything wrong, and Panasonic. Would be the two.
When you look at some of the stats, I think Sony had stated that their engineers could produce like a 0.75, an f0.75 lens on their mount. And their mount is actually smaller than the EOS M mount in terms of the diameter of the mount itself. So while Nikon can produce those crazy lenses, I think that a lot of other manufacturers can also do the same. They're just not going there or not even promoting the fact that they could, because to engineer such a lens would be, I think, a marketing disaster. Well, yeah, Canon did that with the 50mm f1.0 back when they launched the EF mount, and Nikon could not approach that because when they went digital, they could only get to f1.4. The f1.2, I think, was a manual lens. They had a 50mm lens there, and they couldn't go anything beyond that. So now they're all about these f0 point something apertures. That is useful in some very rare cases. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't want that, because Leica has their status symbol of the Noctilux f0.95 50mm lens that I think it has a price tag of $12,000 or $13,000 US to buy it new. So to think that I can adapt that, I can adapt an M-mount lens to an L-mount body. They have the adapter. I own the adapter. I could spend that $13,000 on an F0. No, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, you know what? Again, my point isn't I'm going to do this today. My point is see how things settle. See how the dust falls. Pardon me. And then, you know, 5 years from now, maybe there'll be a proper decision to be made.
And you're right to say like a 5 year kind of window, because these systems do have to mature. As with anything in technology. But at the same time, your camera that you own today is fantastic. It does not need to be replaced on a yearly basis. The quality of your images will improve because you as a photographer become a better photographer, not because you as a photographer have a better camera, right?
And You know what? I can't agree more. One of the things I talk about on a regular basis when people come in, oh, I need a new A7 Mark 12. I need a this and a that. And okay, but what's an aperture? Yeah. You know, you ask, well, what two things does an aperture do?
I'm in the business of selling cameras, but...
I'll sell you anything. But I really want to know if this is just you wanting to spend some money, or is this going to be a game changer in your world of photography, and is this going to help your soul make better photos? You know what I mean? I know it sounds
the first game changing camera for me was the 5D Mark II, because it doubled the resolution of my 5D and it introduced video features. Both of those to me were quite groundbreaking, and it had a noticeable impact on my work. One of the first professional images that I had taken with that was on Christmas Day of 2008, driving up to Sudbury, Ontario, and stopping on the French River Bridge after a fresh snowfall. And I've licensed that image a number of times, and I've made some big prints of that too. I wouldn't have been able to do that as effectively at 12 megapixels as I would have at 21. Now, would have I needed 40? No, it wouldn't have helped me one bit for that photograph at all, at least not in that era. But we're in a changing industry.
It's really funny you say that, because I have in my notes to talk about my first real camera I bought because it was 12 megapixels and not 21. I bought my D700 because I'm shooting 3200 ISO wrestling, and I chose it over the 5D Mark II because I wanted fewer pixels. So it's really fun in photography, and this is something I've learned selling this stuff, is that everybody's needs are totally different. And it's not a matter of this is the camera that everybody should have. It's what do you do? What's in front of you when you go click? Oh, okay, that's what you do. The technology in this camera is built for that. Not more than that, not less than that. Here you go. Here's what you need. Yep. So everybody has the right camera. And I think that's why it's great to see all these new technologies and all this new stuff happening, because it's just opening more people up to the world of photography and self-expression and all the possibilities that kind of go along with it. So I'm all for that in any way. But always remember, it's the user. The best feature on any camera, or the best tool any camera has to offer, is the 12 inches behind it.
Exactly. Now, Brian, I was going to sign off, but I want people to find you online first. Where can people find your work and your community?
Well, Daytripper Photo, you can find the day trips and all the training things that I can run on daytripperphoto.com, www.daytripperphoto.com. Of course, you can find us on the MeWe community, DTPWe. Community, I guess we could say.
We'll put the links in the show notes.
Awesome. And other than that, I'm on Facebook as Daytripper Photo or myself. And if you want to check out my wrestling photography, just look up hashtag Weiss Shot Me, WeissShotMe. And that's all my wrestling stuff.
Fantastic. Brian, thank you so much for being on again. It's always great to talk to you. And I'm looking forward to having you on again in the future. Your opinions are always very valuable.
Appreciate
and
it.
Your points right towards the end about, you know, the person behind the camera being the most meaningful component of a shot really ring true with me. And to that point, I think it's time to get out and shoot.